All right. Mayor, should I get going? All right. Commissioner, if I could have you in the audience, because we have a video that we'd like you to watch. You can't do that from the... Commissioner Nevick, I don't know if you wanted to say a few words first, or if you'd like me to...
Sure. I think that we can take some pride in the fact that we become, as a community in the city, a lot more earthquake aware in the past couple of years. If you look at this edition of Portland Monthly, it has an extensive and a very good article about earthquake awareness. If you look at our budget, it says that we are beginning to commit some money to build a West Side Emergency Response Center.
And if you look at what we've been able to do with PBIM in conjunction with Congressman Blumenauer, we got a little grant to begin helping some people retrofit their homes so that they're bolted with their foundations. We're beginning to do some good stuff. But one really important issue we need to address is the issue of unreinforced masonry buildings. People's wood homes generally, although they could be severely damaged in an earthquake, they're unlikely to collapse in on people and, you know, kill or severely injure them. That is not true with unreinforced masonry buildings. And we've got rules that say that if you make changes to your building, then there are certain triggers to require you to retrofit them. But not every building owner is going to make those changes. We're dealing here in part with what you might call the danger of grandfathers. Commissioner Saltzman last year or earlier this year that said it was time to address the issue of nightclubs that have been in place since before we adopted sprinkler rules, and they posed a fire hazard. And people who own those buildings said, well, there would be an economic hardship to require us to put in sprinklers now. And Commissioner Saltzman said, this is a fire hazard. It needs to be dealt with. And I think that we're coming to the point we need to take a similar approach towards unreinforced masonry buildings. With the understanding, however, that the seismic strengthening of unreinforced masonry buildings is and can be a very expensive undertaking. So if we just announce tomorrow that everybody has to retrofit them, that would be a substantial imposition. And hopefully we can have a timeline that people can live with, and hopefully we can find the resources to have carrots as well as sticks. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Carmen and the team to talk about what the risks are, what some possible solutions.
Right. Sorry, Carla. I'm going to sit down. And the loss of use of these facilities really slows down the city's recovery. In addition to, of course, once they're gone, we lose the historical and cultural character of the city. So today, we're here to talk to you about the extent of the problem, the risks these buildings pose, what's currently being done, some best practices from around the country, and some next steps forward. We have you out here because there's a couple of videos that we want you to see. Carla's asked me to remind you that please hold off on any questions because you're not mic'd, or if you do have a question, I will repeat it in the mic and then answer it. We'll have you come join us back at the table. And so I'm going to have it kick off with Yume from Dagami.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. Thanks for having me here. And thanks for having this work session. So my basic message today is that we have earthquakes in Portland, and these earthquakes can shake pretty hard and a long time, and this is a problem where you have weak soils that produce ground failure and where you have weak buildings. And it would be a good idea to do something about that. So buildings can be built well to withstand big earthquakes. and they can just flex with that ground movement. And I have a couple of videos here to show you. There's a lot of engineering and science that goes into earthquake engineering, and here you have it in just a few seconds. On the left, you have a wood frame building. I would say go ahead. It's being subjected to ground shaking in a laboratory. And you can see it's flexing kind of like a piece of licorice. It's doing pretty well. And then on the right, you have an unreinforced masonry building, a brick building. Go ahead and click it. And this building, you know, basically collapses very quickly. It's snaps like a candy cane, and it's a problem if you have a lot of people in them. So what you have, here's a map with faults of Oregon. You see that the Portland area has some faults around it. We'll take a closer look. And right offshore, you have a big fault called the Cascadia Fault, and we'll take a look at that as well. Doesn't show up real well, but this is the latest and greatest from the U.S. Geological Survey on the Portland area faults. You may be able to see a couple of long red lines. Those are faults that are active, and they can produce about magnitude 7 earthquakes. I highlighted the two that are kind of the scariest to me. And if you notice that they're trending in the northwest direction, which is consistent with the way that the Earth is getting squeezed here, these numbers here are basically, they're like velocities. They indicate the seismic level of activity for these faults. And we would consider them kind of on the low side. In contrast, there's a fault offshore here, off the Pacific Northwest, and it can produce a magnitude 9 earthquake. This is the one that's the disaster waiting to happen. When it occurs, it will shake the western part of the Pacific Northwest quite hard, cause a lot of damage, and also a tsunami in low-lying areas along the coast. And it will also damage the valley, and especially the weak buildings and where you have ground that's susceptible to ground failure. So the insidious thing about this fault is that when it ruptures, it can shake a very long time, much longer than a California-style earthquake. And this graph is depicts that a Cascadia earthquake can shake a long time, on the order of 60 seconds or so. And for an engineer, this is a long time, because buildings have a hard time tolerating being shaken that long. In contrast, this is acceleration time history. It's the shaking with time for a California earthquake. This happens to be from the 1994 Northridge earthquake. And you can see that it shakes significantly there for about 10 seconds. So we're in the, so Portland is in the boat to receive both these kinds of earthquakes, but the one that has a much higher likelihood of occurring is this one. And you can see that shaking can last a long time for the buildings, and then the shaking that people would perceive would last a lot longer, on the order of maybe 5 minutes. And that's because, you know, it's kind of like a train going by. You can feel those vibrations, but they're not at a level that's going to cause any building damage. So this is my last slide. You know, the big questions are really, you know, when, where, and how big. And we can't tell you when exactly, but we can tell you, given time, it's 100% probability that a magnitude 9 Cascadia earthquake will occur. If you look at this timeline here, it's 10,000 years, and every thicker red tick is a magnitude 9 size-ish earthquake, and every smaller red tick is a magnitude 8 size earthquake, which is also extremely big. It's a lot of energy release. So over the past 10,000 years, researchers have found 41 very, very large earthquakes that have been produced by the Cascadia Fault, and the last one being about a magnitude 9 on January 26, 1700. So it's been a few hundred years. In terms of what engineers design for, currently we design, our design takes into account these probabilities, about a 10 to 12% likelihood for a magnitude 9 in the next 50 years, and a 20 to 40% probability of a magnitude 8 occurring on the southern Cascadia coastline, which is more active. It's southern Oregon, a magnitude 8. And that earthquake there would produce much less significant shaking than than a magnitude 9 earthquake. Did that make sense? The shaking would be less here in Portland. So the Portland area faults are less active. They would occur on less frequently, on the order of thousands, many thousands of years, versus the Cascadia Fault occurs on the order of a few hundred years. Okay, so that's what I have for you. If you have any questions now or later, feel free to let me know. And I'll pass it off to...
All right, good morning. just briefly, I want to introduce the issue of soil liquefaction. Liquefaction is a hazard that affects the stability of soils during an earthquake. It's a hazard that has caused serious and significant damage to properties and buildings in previous earthquakes. And it's also a hazard we face here in Portland as well. Just to give you an idea conceptually of what occurs with soil liquefaction during an earthquake, I've got a schematic up there in the lower right-hand corner. And if we could zoom in or take a close-up view of a soil layer, we would see that it is made up of particles of soil. And those soil particles are loosely arranged generally, but they are in contact with one another to form a stable soil mass. And where we're below the water table with those soils, the space between the particles is filled with water. When we shake those soils or subject them to strong shaking from an earthquake, the particles want to rearrange themselves and compress into a denser state. Much like if you had a bucket of loose marbles and you shook it, those marbles would settle and consolidate into a tighter packing. That's what the particles want to try to do during an earthquake. But to do that, the space between the particles is filled with water, and that water has to be squeezed out or compressed out of the soil. If that water can't do that quick enough, the pressure in the water builds, and that pressure actually separates the particles of soil. And it's in that temporary state where the soil behaves more like a liquid than it does a solid. The strength of the soil goes way down. Eventually, that water does dissipate, often moving up towards the ground surface and coming out to the ground surface, and the particles then consolidate and become back in contact with one another, again, achieving that stable mass. Next slide. Soils susceptible to liquefaction generally include loose, sandy, and silty soils. And in Portland, we have a lot of these soils along the rivers of the Willamette River and the Columbia River. These are the sediments that were deposited by these rivers. They're generally deposited in a very loose state. They're close to the rivers, so they're below the water table. On the map up there in the lower left, there should have been a legend there. You can see the red, yellow, and green colors. The red is the high hazard areas where there's significant thicknesses of liquefiable soils. The yellow is sort of the moderate hazard areas where we have liquefiable soils. The groundwater table may not be as high, so there's not as much of those soils below the water table. And the green areas show areas where we have liquefiable soils, but they're generally not below the water table except for periodic times during the year. Back to that slide just real quick. So you can see, the high hazard areas are located closest to the rivers. And if you were able to kind of zoom in on the central city area there, you would see that a big part of that area is built on soils susceptible to liquefaction. Next slide. Thank you. So some of the hazards associated with liquefaction are, again, this reduction in the soil strength, surface disruption and sand boils. In the upper right-hand corner, you can see a sand boils. This is where the water pressure was so high, it ejected water up through the ground surface. It carried sand and silt sediments up with it and ejected it out onto the surface. Loss of foundation bearing support. The middle right-hand slide there, you can see a well-built building stayed together well, but its foundation failed and the whole building tipped over because of that loss of foundation support. Also, settlement. In the lower middle there, you can see a building that settled almost 2 feet just because of the consolidation of the sandy soils that liquefied. And also lateral spreading and slope instability. In the lower left there, you see an example from the Nisqually earthquake in Olympia, where there's a lake off to the left there, and that embankment, because of the liquefiable soils, just failed and moved out laterally. This could be a serious issue along the riverbanks of the Willamette Columbia River. And then finally, flotation of buried tanks and utilities. The buoyancy uplift forces caused by liquefiable soil are almost twice that of normal groundwater. So this can cause utilities or buried tanks to rise up out of the ground because of those forces. Just one final point I'll make. UMay showed a nice video right at the start showing the collapse of that URM building. Those buildings are very stiff, very brittle, and so the deformation of the ground caused by liquefaction has a bigger impact on those buildings because they just can't tolerate that deformation. They're not flexible enough to do that. Thank you.
Sit down. Good morning. My name is Amit Kumar. I'm a senior structural engineer with the Bureau of Development Services. So over the next several minutes here, I just wanted to give you some information on what a URM building is, what the hazards posed by these URM buildings are, how many of these URM buildings we have in the city of Portland, what are the practices that other cities have employed to mitigate this hazard, what are the policies that we have here at the city of Portland to mitigate these hazards too, what the status of the URM buildings here and this policy is, and then also what the path forward is, and then what is the cost of doing nothing. So to start off with is the unreinforced masonry is basically it's a building with bearing walls that have got no steel in it, that the steel provides the ductility and also the strength for a building. So masonry is basically made of earthen materials. As you can see on the left side, mostly for the most common materials are brick or a hollow concrete block. And here are some examples of URM buildings in the city of Portland. So these are, I think, the southwest portion of Portland. This is a two-story, multi-story URM building. And this is an example of a URM building that has been retrofitted on an apartment building. So this, in contrast to a brick veneer, where brick veneer is just basically a veneer in front of a concrete wall or a masonry wall, or it's just a facing on those buildings. And in contrast to URM buildings, URM building, the walls take the loads from the floors and the roofs, whereas in brick veneer, it's just a veneer that's adhered to the backup. So what we are going to be concentrating is on the URM buildings, the ones buildings that take the loads from the floors and the roofs. So starting, I think, in the late 1800s and when continuing on till about 1940 or 1950, URM buildings were constructed mainly because of its durability, its fire resistance, and architectural characters. And you can see those in a lot of schools, hospital, city halls, and other apartment buildings. So how do these masonry buildings perform in an earthquake? Historically, you know, these masonry buildings have really not performed very well. It's just been shown to be one of the most riskiest buildings that are there and are very subject to falling down. So the hazards posed by these URM buildings can basically be classified into three different types. The first one is injury. These masonry buildings are, you know, they weigh at least about 120 pounds a square foot. So you can imagine if one of these buildings fall, it's a serious risk to people on the pedestrian, not only to the occupants of the building, but also to pedestrians and to adjacent buildings. So here's an example of, you know, the parapets in these are very commonly fallen down. They fall down very commonly, and they're because they are not attached to the walls. The walls are not attached to the floors. And here's an example of the parapet falling down. This is a photograph of the Molalla High School in the 1993 Scott Mills earthquake. And you can see the gable end has fallen down. So in addition to the hazards posed to the pedestrians, they also block the right-of-way and also the emergency transportation routes that severely impact our rescue and recovery efforts. So here are further examples of what happens in these buildings. The second is the property damage. So experience from our past earthquakes has basically shown that these buildings are the type where they are very vulnerable to earthquake, and it's very difficult to put these buildings back together. As you can see, it's like a Humpty Dumpty back together again. So some examples of how these buildings fall down. So one of the common construction practices that was during the construction was when they build these, they did not tie these exterior walls to the floors of the building. So when you get an earthquake and a shaking back and forth, these walls can separate out, causing a partial or complete collapse of these floors on the building. So here's another example of what happens. The second hazard is basically a loss of use. Is again, these buildings suffer such major damage that they are out of commission for several years together. And then so we have to find some alternate accommodation for the tenants of these buildings. And so loss of use is another hazard posed. So these hazards cause a lot of damage to the buildings. It affects the city's resiliency. And these are the photographs of, I believe, the central business district in Christchurch. The photograph to the left that you see is the building before the series of earthquakes that happened in between 2010 and 2011. What you see on the right side is an aerial photograph of the same business district, where it's estimated that over 70% of all the buildings had to be demolished after an earthquake there. And even today, about 4 or 5 years, I think most of the buildings in the central business district in Christchurch are still empty lots. They have not been able to rebuild them. So you can see how that impacts the resiliency of the city. So what is, how many buildings do we have here in the city of Portland that are unreinforced masonry? So back in 1993, Commissioner Kafuri had appointed a seismic task force to examine the status of the buildings. And one of the tasks that was done as part of this seismic task force was to make an inventory of all the buildings that we have. And from that, it was determined that we had about 1,200 to 1,300 buildings that were categorized as URM buildings. And that's about 9% of our building stock. This was in about 1994.
This is all central city?
Or? No, this is through the whole city of Portland.
Well, so why only 14,000 buildings? These
are mostly commercial buildings. And so these buildings by use, which you can see mostly either commercial or multifamily buildings, about 80% of them. And there are about, most of them are two stories or less. And by areas, they occupy about 20,000 square feet or less. So here is a list, is a map that shows the URM buildings that are city-owned or are schools. And then I believe the yellow or the brown that you see is the area of liquefaction zones, which is what Doug was mentioning about. So a combination of these URM buildings on liquefaction zone is a really deadly combination here. So it's almost, that could lead to collapse of these structures. So these are kind of difficult to see. We have blown up maps of these here. We can talk about later on. So this is the overall, from that database that we had, this is the these are the locations of all the URMs within the city of Portland.
And I think what's important to note is you'll see that quite a few are clustered around our emergency routes. And the reason for that is, like, they used to be located along the old streetcar lines. Those lines are now primarily our emergency routes, and they're heavily clustered around it. So if they fall, they generate a lot of debris, they block the right-of-way, and they block the ability of our fire and law enforcement vehicles to get around them.
This is just a close-up of the central city here. They're showing all the, in red, those are the URM buildings. Again, these are just from the database that we had in from 1993. So, you know, we have seen that these URM buildings are very hazardous, and so what can we do to reduce this potential threat to life and property? Several cities on the West Coast that are vulnerable to earthquakes have adopted policies to require retrofit of these URM buildings or have them demolished, or they have asked that these occupancy of these buildings be reduced. So California was probably one of the first states to recognize these hazards, and in 1986, they passed a law asking the local jurisdictions to identify all these potentially hazardous buildings and then come up with strategies to mitigate this problem. Out of this, there were four mitigation measures that arose. The first one was what they call as a mandatory strengthening, where the local jurisdictions required that the building owners improve the performance of these buildings for, in the case of a seismic event. And they prescribed a time frame over which they needed to upgrade these buildings. And that measure was proved to be the most effective in obtaining compliance. The second one was voluntary strengthening, where the owners were required to do an evaluation study to show what the risk of their building is in an earthquake, and then whether they upgraded or not was left up to their discretion. And the third was classified as other measures, where things like they're just required to place placards on the buildings, informing the tenants and others that the building is unsafe during an earthquake, or they had some passive triggers like change of occupancy. When that was triggered, then they would have to do an upgrade of the building. And the last was basically notification, where the jurisdiction simply mailed out letters to owners saying that the building in this type of construction has been known to fail in an earthquake. And this was the least effective of all of them. So some of the cities that had these measures, like Los Angeles, required mandatory upgrades. And then of the 6,300 URM buildings, only two have been left that have not been retrofitted. City of San Francisco had same mandatory upgrade requirements, and of the 2,000, 1,850 buildings have been retrofitted. This is based from, I think, the data that we had from 2010. So since then, I think there have been a little bit more compliance.
What was the time frame?
It varied. It varied from about 10 years to 15 years. So different cities have adopted different strengthening methods that are there, and so depending on what they required, it varied quite a bit. City of San Diego had a two-tiered system where they required the mandatory requirements to brace the parapets and to attach the walls, because those are the most common type of failures that we see in URM. And then there were triggers that needed to strengthen it if they hit those triggers. And City of Oakland also had some mandatory requirements, but what the strengthening schemes were to a lower standard. So based on the study of these measures, it was determined that the mandatory strengthening programs with accompanying penalties had the highest rate of compliance, with about 87% of the buildings being retrofitted or demolished. And only about 13 to 31% of showed compliance for the other measures that were there. So this difference is really telling in that voluntary notification and other reduction programs have not proved effective in compelling owners to seismically strengthen their buildings. City of Seattle currently is now proposing a mandatory retrofit policy. As far as I know, at this point, they have a policy in place, but it's under consideration right now. It's under public hearings. So what are the policies here at the City of Portland here? So the seismic task force that was appointed in 1993, their work resulted in the Chapter 2485, which is the governing code right now for existing buildings and for upgrading existing URM buildings here. So what does this Title 2485 require? So for URMs, it basically requires that when the roof is replaced or the building is altered or repaired, you need to strengthen the buildings. So the first trigger is basically roof replacement. So if the roof is replaced over a five-year period, 50% of the roof is replaced over a five-year period, they are required to braze the chimneys and to attach the exterior wall to the roof. So that's the first trigger that we have. The second trigger is basically the alteration. So it's a monetary trigger. If work being done on the building exceeds a certain monetary threshold, for example, if it's a single-story building, if it exceeds $54 a square foot, or for two-story or more, if it exceeds $41 a square foot, then you're required to upgrade this building to a certain standard. And these the numbers are adjusted on an annual basis based on the cost of construction index. And the third trigger is a change of occupancy in the building. So if the building is going from a lower hazard category to a higher hazard category, and if there are more than one-third of the building is affected by that, or if the increase in occupant load of 149 people or more, then you're required to upgrade the building. So it classifies all the buildings in based on the exposure of a number of people into different hazard categories, the five being the highest. And you can see that's where the exposure to the number of people is the highest. We have like assembly use, large restaurants, and then the lowest is basically when you have single family dwellings and for storage. So if you're going from a lower category to a higher category in the change, that triggers the seismic upgrade. Title 24 also requires that buildings, when there is the cost of alteration exceeds a certain trigger, that they do an evaluation of the building for seismic risk. But this does not trigger any requirement for any upgrade. It's just a study that is required. We also have provisions for voluntary seismic upgrade, where owners can voluntarily upgrade the buildings to any standard as long as they don't make the building less safe. In order to encourage these seismic upgrades, there is a provision in there that allows that this work for seismic upgrades be done over a 10-year period at the discretion of the director. And then there are fee reductions where for the seismic work, we reduce the fees or eliminate the fees if there's less than, the fees are total less than $2,500. So we have these policies here. So I guess the question is, what is the problem that we're facing right now? So the problem that we face basically is that in the 20 years or so that we have had these policies in place, we estimate only about 15 to 20% of the buildings have been upgraded at this point. So we still have a vast majority of building stock that is vulnerable. And we have seen that a lot of building owners try to get around these requirements for the seismic triggers and not doing the change of occupancies or not increasing the occupant load on the people.
So 15-20% in 20 years, do you have a sense of whether that's accelerating, we're getting more of them now that they're constructed, the real estate market is better, or we're getting less of them because these buildings are already done?
Yeah, I mean, the sense that we get, again, is there's no pace or accelerated pace of. It's still the same. People always try to find ways to get around those triggers, and that's a pretty common thing that you see. So,
I guess, Mayor, to your question, why hasn't more been done? Well, quite frankly, the economics of these retrofits don't pencil out. We've heard also that there's a lack of construction financing available, lack of low-interest loans, and we need to do more as a city to provide incentives and remove any disincentives from moving these program forward.
Okay. I'm going to sit down so I can use the mic. I'm Peter Englander from the Portland Development Commission, and the timing is exactly right for the discussion. Why haven't more buildings been done? I first want to mention that certainly the Portland Development Commission has participated in a lot of seismic upgrades in a number of buildings, a number of those in Old Town Chinatown. I could list off a few of these that you'll all be familiar with, whether it's the University of Oregon White Stag Building, the Mercy Corps Building, the General Auto Building on the Park Blocks, Vestas, Oregon College of Oriental Medicine. We've helped with all of these buildings, and I think that one of the key factors that I want to make sure that you're understanding exactly what Carmen said, in each of these situations, a very complex financing package has had to be put together. All of these buildings, every single one that I've mentioned and every one that I can think of, including a good majority of the affordable housing in Old Town Chinatown, a lot of the commercial buildings have done with a combination of historic tax credits and the syndication of those tax credits so that the proceeds of that syndication be can invested in the building. New market tax credits, which is a phenomenon that's only about 12 years old, have been done in combination with the historic tax credits. And then even with those particular tools and the proceeds from them, PDC has also provided low interest, well, in today's markets, interest loans that have gone anywhere from 0% to about 3%. And we've participated in just about every single building that's been upgraded in Old Town Chinatown and many of the unreinforced buildings that have been upgraded in the central city. Our understanding, and I'm not an expert on this, but our understanding is that the cost to upgrade is somewhere between $30 and $50 a square foot. So if you think of a quarter block building, 10,000 square feet, you take the average, that's $400,000 per floor. And so when I think about the White Stag building, that was over 100,000 square feet. You can just calculate that the seismic upgrades to that particular project was about 10% of the overall project cost. And so what I've tried to be able to illustrate here is the fact that there is no increased rent, no increased income that comes from the seismic upgrades. So you can reinforce your building and you can't get more rent for them. This reminds me of what the green building industry used to be like many, many years ago. We committed to a green building program, but you didn't get any additional rent for it. So it was something that you really had to commit to do. I think in this particular case, the costs are that much more. They're not recognized. Therefore, when these buildings are appraised for financing, the appraisal doesn't go up. The value does not go up because of that. So that gap starts to exist in those situations. And this is when all of these very, very complex structures have to be put into place. Those complex structures take very sophisticated borrowers. And thus, when Amit put up the chart that talked about the number of buildings and the size of those buildings, I think 10% of the buildings of our building stock are the largest buildings. Those are the ones that are getting upgraded because they tend to have the more sophisticated borrowers, and you can get much more economies of scale in each one of them. So you need a committed borrower. You need a committed lender that's going to be able to put together these structures. Historic tax credits you can just get, but new market tax credits are allocated. So you putting together these packages is quite a production, and it takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of patience, and a significant amount of risk because you're the building owner is investing a lot up front, expecting all of these proceeds to then be invested in the building. And still with all of that, PDC has been involved with these loans as well. So your question, Commissioner Fritz, is why aren't the lenders recognizing this? Why aren't they willing to? And they are responding to the market. So the lender has to underwrite a cash flow that the building produces. So they can't lend more and not have a way in which the loan can be repaid. So they say, well, sure, we would prefer the loan be seismically upgraded, but if you can't get more rent, if there's not additional income that comes from the building, then I can't finance anymore. And so I think that they would, I can't speak. I'm not we've done what we've done. I can't respond to how the banks will lend or not lend. I mean, I think that's a good question for lenders.
Basically, the banks are sort of responding to what prospective tenants do. And now prospective tenants don't care about whether a building is seismically strengthened or not, so the income stream doesn't change.
That's correct. That's correct.
Risk driver for those lenders that, you know, I'm lending $2 million on this building, there's a, you know, X percent chance that it'll be a total loss in the first 5 years of the loan. Why am I not requiring that the borrower insure me against that risk?
I don't see how this is any different from ABA. Presumably, they don't charge more rent to people needing accommodations and in an accessible apartment, which costs more. Why is that?
You know, I would say it's a matter of the strictness of the code, and what their choices are, and which buildings they are willing that they choose to finance, and that and what buildings are brought to them. Now, you just mentioned that you think some
banks are requiring that the building itself be insured before they will provide funding for it. If you want to pay for it, you can get it.
We've had one instance of late where the lender has told the borrower, I won't lend on your property unless you do the seismic upgrade and can get insurance, and then I'll lend on your building to do the renovation. But that's a relatively new, probably within the last 9 months, bit of change in the market that awareness is going on. And I do think the tenants oftentimes are unaware of whether their building's been seismically upgraded or not. You enter a restaurant or a business every day, and there's no poster on the side of the building that says, this building will collapse in event of an earthquake. It is not seismically reinforced. And so there's no, you know, much like the lead plaque that you got on the outside of the building that helps raise the awareness of those green attributes to a building. Some people think the U that we now see in our city is about unreinforced, but that's a fire marshal, unsafe to enter structure. But if you had peer pressure or market pressure or tenant pressure to elevate that awareness of what's going on with this structure, is it seismically reinforced, to what level, that type of information might also help provide the market to be able to make better decisions on lending, renting, other improvements that might be requested.
I think there also in California, when this mandatory requirements were put in place, initially there was a lot of resistance from building owners to that requirements until the insurance industry came on board. So I think it was city of Berkeley or one of the cities down there where the insurance industry said that we are not going to insure the buildings. And when that happened, the building owners were on board, and then they worked with the city to come up with the programs that they could work with.
So why lenders and their insurers aren't leaning on property owners at least as hard as we might with regulation? So it kind of surprises me that it would be possible to finance these buildings. If now we know the risk, you've just explained it to us, it's public information. We know the odds of a major earthquake are significant. Lenders know that too. So strange that they would, insist on working smoke detectors in the building, but not insist on seismic parking if they're going to make a major loan. I'm still surprised that banks have generally been more conservative than government, is another way to express it. And why they're not being more conservative than this is surprising.
Of course, if you're not borrowing any money, if you're just keeping the building for its existing use and not doing anything to it, then you don't have to worry about it.
Right, exactly.
And I will tell you, I've seen buildings get financed that aren't getting seismically upgraded. So I have seen it happen. I think what all of you are saying is that the more that the market, and Andy says this too, the market is starting to get more educated. You know, I think this article that just came out, which I didn't even know was happening, when it showed up in my doorstep this week, and I thought, fabulous. You know, finally the market is starting to become more aware of this. So, and I think, Commissioner Novick, I think your point is very, very valid, and we've certainly seen that as well. When I think of, and this is my second to last point, we've seen these three categories. Those that are very, very active, they know they have to make the seismic upgrades, they figure out through this very complex structure how to make that happen. There are those that are going underneath that trigger, and then there are those that are doing nothing to their buildings or doing minimal things to their buildings. So I think it does fall into those categories. The last point I think Carmen wanted me to make was what happens when we do see it. And there have been a couple of instances that I'd like to highlight where we've had significant and coordinated efforts in seismic upgrading a number of buildings. And the ones, the effort that I like to point to that I think is most dramatic is all that we all did around the Ankeny Burnside development framework, where 9 different buildings got seismically upgraded. It all happened within a very, very short period of time. And the economic benefit of that has been pretty, pretty large, both in terms of the number of jobs that came into a particular area because all of these buildings were getting upgraded at the same time, the number of visits by people in both as patient visits at the Oregon College of Oriental Medicine and the number of events that University of Oregon has had. All of these things, the number of jobs, all of them have increased dramatically because of the concentrated effort of upgrading a number of these buildings all at the same time and bringing attention to them. There's a lot of interest in these unreinforced masonry buildings in the market in the sense that they have a lot of character. And so on one hand, I think people want to occupy those buildings. On the other hand, they don't pay attention to this rent differential. And I'm thinking of buildings in particular, those that have been and those haven't been. The market isn't making decisions yet to say, I will not occupy that building because it's not reinforced currently. So I think that further education is important. And the other example I'll give you that I think was pretty dramatic was the seismic upgrading that happened at the Holman building on the east side, where we brought 2 companies into a former warehouse, and a significant cost of seismic upgrades was incorporated into that refinancing. We brought 200 jobs into the city, and 2 companies are occupied there, as well as the Portland Boathouse. One company is growing so much, they're now growing into a building across the street. So there is positive economic impact when we can find ways in which to improve these structures.
So just wanted to continue with the presentation here. So in 1993, the seismic task force that Commissioner Kafuri commissioned, they undertook an earthquake risk analysis, and their conclusion was that URM buildings were the most vulnerable to damage, even in a small earthquake, and that these the seismic upgrades of URM buildings were the only construction type that showed a positive cost-benefit ratio. And then, you know, based on an experience with what California did, it seems like mandatory upgrades were the most effective method of compliance. Next.
Okay.
One more. Yeah. So one possible strategy is to require some sort of mandatory upgrade for these URM buildings within a prescribed time frame. And we all recognize that these are a big burden to building owners. And so we need to provide some incentives. And some of these incentives could be allowing these upgrades to be done over a reasonable time period, which is what we currently have. Decoupling seismic upgrades from other required upgrades like ADA or, you know, providing bike racks or sprinkler systems. Creating a property tax abatement or state income tax credit, or bond finance grants, levies, including seismic upgrades for URM to qualify for funding under urban renewal programs, transfer of development rights, subsidizing seismic assessments. So these are basically seismic evaluations on existing buildings. And I believe this is currently available or being used through being funded by PDC on some of the buildings right now. Creating a lead-like rating system for seismically upgrading buildings, which creates a market incentive for owners to upgrade their buildings. This is right now, there's a national effort going on to create that kind of a system. Providing protection from liability that might arise due to notice of seismic risk contained in the inventory of reports.
Explain what, I don't understand what that means.
Which one?
The liability.
So it's basically like, you know, when owners and engineers are, they know that there's a risk to this building and they come up, they write a report on what these risks are. If nothing is done, or then they're exposed to a liability on this issue. So providing that liability protection against them might encourage them to provide, do some additional work on it.
Would that have to be done by the state legislature, or who could provide that kind of protection?
Probably the state legislature, I would imagine.
Well, it would be a reason to do the assessment, because if you don't...
Right. So as long as they're doing this work to upgrade the building, then you can provide that kind of protection, not just a blanket liability.
So it would sort of eliminate the incentive to know nothing.
Right. Correct.
We do require that if you hit a certain dollar threshold, you have to do the ASC 31 report, which is submitted to the city.
Right.
It does become a public document, and I've heard from some building owners that it does exist there and can exist on the title of that building. Therefore, anybody that goes to purchase that building can also review that report, which identifies the weaknesses within the structure. There's no requirement for the owner to do anything about those weaknesses in the building, but it does lend a liability on the building itself. It says, here's a building, here's the identified problems. We're waiting for the next shoe to fall, essentially, for that building to be upgraded.
Correct.
He also makes more explicit reduction in the value of that property.
Education.
Yeah, so, and then the other is to fund some educational programs. So I think, again, this is like, you know, a lot of people, the general public doesn't understand what the risks are with the URM buildings. So, you know, talking about generating additional rent, maybe when the people are educated more, they might demand.
Although, didn't you say that in California cities that, like, required posting of the dangers of unreinforced masonry buildings, that had a pretty uneven impact?
Right.
What do you mean by uneven? Like, it prompted some building owners to do something, but not all that many.
Right. So it was a pretty random. Retrofitting of URM buildings does work. So this is an example of a building in Christchurch again, where the building was retrofitted, and the damage you can see was very limited in the earthquake there. So this is the same building from the inside of the building. So if we don't do anything, I just wanted to end here with what we could possibly see. So these are some photographs, again, from New Zealand Christchurch there. They have the same type of URM buildings. So we had before the earthquake, and this is what happened after the earthquake. This is another building before, and this is after. This is a URM building, again, in Christchurch, and this is what happened after the earthquake. This is a church which is kind of similar to what we have here in Southwest Portland. So that was what it was before the earthquake, and this is what it looked after the earthquake in here. So another example, before and after. And this was a building that was damaged, an earthquake in New Zealand in September of 2010. And as you can see, there's a little bit of damage in the left-hand side of this building. And then there was another earthquake that happened in February of 2011, and this building collapsed in that earthquake here. And so this is a building in URM Portland before and then after.
Carla's going to yell at me if I don't invite you back up here to the table and make sure that you're all mic'd for this next portion. So thank you for your indulgence in sitting out there. I guess at this time, I'd like to invite any members of the public that would like to come up and testify. I don't know if there are anyone that's signed up for testimony. No? Oh. Okay.
Yeah, one, while you're coming up, another thing I'm curious about is that we have this, I think it's a fire code-based provision in which we place a U symbol on certain buildings. I think that has to do with fire code compliance, not with seismic compliance. And I think that means you can still occupy the building, but it's unsafe for firefighters to enter. What's the code basis for that? And the reason I'm bringing this up is that, you know, maybe there's some fine-grained approaches here, that there are certain buildings that are so egregious that they shouldn't be occupied. Right now they're partially occupied because there's a bar on the ground floor, there's plywood on the upper floors, and the building is deemed unsafe for firefighters to enter. Perhaps that building is so unsafe it shouldn't be, no one should be entering it. Whereas there are other buildings that maybe are, you know, in a somewhat less vulnerable condition from either a fire and life safety or a seismic standpoint. In other words, are there gradations between unreinforced and reinforced where we ought to be paying attention to the partial condition of the building?
There are gradations, and we do have not only unreinforced masonry, but we have some concrete buildings that are not terribly reinforced. We have some large warehouse buildings that are occupied sparsely. They have a lower hazard classification to them and a lower occupancy rating that are built and, you know, are subject to some of the same behaviors as these URMs. Not nearly as dramatic in the sense that they won't collapse brick by brick, but you'd have large panel, tilt-up panels that are subject to failure as well. Those are buildings that, as long as they don't go through a change of occupancy or an increase in hazard, they don't trigger the 2485, our seismic code, to do any upgrades on them. We have seen some of those where they've changed an occupant load or occupant level in there that have gone through an occupant or some partial seismic upgrade on those to make them better. Mm-hmm. So we do treat each of those buildings independently and review their characteristics, get upgrades to those as necessary, but they have to hit that threshold, and that's really where we find the debate between the proposal that comes in the door and us trying to get those improvements done for the building, which is a relatively gray, can be a gray area in there when you're looking at cost per square foot or occupant load.
So there are a lot of buildings, as the mayor said, where there's a ground floor occupancy, but the upper floors are vacant. Is that because they're avoiding the seismic upgrade triggers by doing that?
Typically, they haven't been able to, and Peter could probably answer that, on the one hand is they can't get enough rents on the second floor, third floor, to make those pay for themselves and do any upgrades up there. They can continue to occupy the first floor as a space that provides enough rent for the building owner to continue operation. To revamp and do the second and third floor would cost enough that it would trigger the full seismic upgrade, and then they'd be into spending more than what they wanted to or thought they could get a return on as part of that investment. So yes, we'd find that the first floor in many of these places will stay occupied with the old use in there. And the second and third floor will be vacant and stay vacant for years and decades.
Yeah, I think, one of the triggers in the decrement floor is that the cost of the moderation is only for a 2-year period.
Correct.
So what some of the building owners do is they come in and occupy one floor and then do the work to avoid the seismic upgrade and come back 2 years later, and that cost for that upgrade at that point doesn't count. Starts fresh. So then they occupy the second floor and then the next floor. So we have seen a couple of buildings where people have not done an upgrade because the cost was going, was triggering the seismic upgrade.
Well, welcome. You two know a little bit about buildings in Portland, so we're glad you're here.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
No, sir, push your button. There's a button in front.
Big button, sorry.
I'm actually here in place of Walt McMonies. I'm Liz Tilbury.